good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 587 of Unwelcome Guests, Engineering the Stench of Urban Decay. I'm Robin Upton. That rather quizzical title is a reference to the different strands of thought which I'm going to weave together into this week's show. In our second hour, a vintage recording of Ivan Illich speaking about water, the history of the sense of smell, and with special relevance to the growth of cities. In our first hour, two more contemporary speakers challenging orthodox thought about life in the inner cities. We're going to start the show with Steve Masek. This is courtesy of Labour Beat, a 2007 recording entitled Demonizing the Inner City, Ideology and the Urban Poor. This is the soundtrack of a video which is downloadable from our website at unwelcomeguest.net/587.
The mainstream corporate media for the past three or four decades has demonized the inner city as a kind of lawless place and the people living there as barbaric, unruly, savage, and bizarre. And in my book, Urban Nightmares, I take a close look at why this happened. But the story behind the book is that in the mid-1990s, I started to notice in the news media this obsession, this hysterical obsession with lawlessness, immorality, and crime supposedly exploding in the inner city. And a lot of it took place in the aftermath of the so-called Rodney King riots in Los Angeles in 1992, where the African-American and Latino populations of South Central LA, in response to the acquittal of these police officers who'd been guilty of really flagrant police brutality against a black motorist, Rodney King, took to the streets, and things quickly got out of control, and there was some looting and some burning of cars and clashes with the police that took place. And in the aftermath of that event, and throughout, I would argue, most of the mid-1990s, you saw the news media all of a sudden developing this obsession with the inner city and with the immorality and disorder and criminality of the inner city. And I, in my book, was interested in figuring out why this was happening and why it is that, as I start off the book by talking about the fact that Time magazine in the 90s carried these two cover stories about urban issues. One was a story about the problems of New York City that featured this illustration of New York basically as a Dante-esque hell, you know, overcrawling with prostitutes, of police doing battle with gangs, and it was headlined "The Rotting of the Big Apple." And then 2 years later, they did a similar kind of story that had a similar grim and scary cover about Los Angeles that was called "Los Angeles is the City of Angels Going to Hell?" And it seemed to me that those two Time magazine covers were symptomatic of a broader public mood that you saw in television news accounts and television news coverage, day-to-day coverage of urban issues, whether it be poverty, whether it be homelessness, whether it be public housing, urban development and deindustrialization, or street crime. You saw it in the kinds of fictional television shows that were carried by the major networks in the 90s. Shows like NYPD Blue and Homicide, Life on the Streets. These shows that were sort of fixated on the image of the lawless inner city. You saw it also, or you heard it also, in the rhetoric of mainstream politicians throughout the late 1980s and through the 1990s. So, for example, you had a figure and I'm sure we all still remember him, a figure like Rudolph Giuliani, who was, you know, a former prosecutor who got himself elected mayor of New York City by promising to get to rid the streets of squeegee men. And at the same time, on the other coast, you had Richard Reardon, the first white Republican to get elected mayor of Los Angeles in a very, very long time, running on a campaign slogan of being tough enough to turn Los Angeles around, basically suggesting that what Los Angeles needed was a stern disciplinarian who would crack down on the unruly population of the city as a way of reviving the economic and social and cultural fortunes of Los Angeles. And it wasn't just local politicians who were doing this in their rhetoric, who were demonizing the inner city for political gain. You also saw it at the national level, right? I mean, going back to you know, Ronald Reagan bashing welfare queens, up through Bill Clinton, you know, and his pledge to put hundreds of thousands of new police on the streets to bring order to our inner cities and to reform welfare as we know it, to instill discipline in the urban poor. This was a recurrent theme in American political rhetoric. In my book, I argue that this image of the inner city and the image of the demonic image of the urban poor is a really old one. It's not, in fact, anything new at all. It's got very, very old roots that go back really to the late Victorian era. In the late 19th century, both here in the United States and over in Great Britain, the bourgeoisie, the ruling elite, were alarmed by basically the fruits of the economic system that was enriching them. Right? This was the moment at which you have the creation of a class of the ultra-rich, right? The corporate elite. This is, you know, this was at the moment of the rise of the modern corporation, and with it the rise of a truly affluent corporate elite. At the same time, you had famously in the late 19th century in New York, in London, here in Chicago, the formation of really desperate slums, of places where you had whole families crammed together in a room about this size, you know, 10 by 10, living without indoor plumbing. This posed a problem for the late Victorian bourgeoisie, because here they were telling the world that capitalism, this economic system that was finally, had been unfettered in the late 19th century. You finally had the supposed fruits of industrial capitalism, were emerging into clear view. This economic system that was supposedly going to benefit everyone was creating the most desperate slums, the most horrific, and impoverished environments in human history. The very existence of slums like Whitechapel and Spitalfields in London had basically, was the best recruiting tool for the socialist movement and the anti-capitalist movement in the late 19th century, because it was living proof that capitalism failed at providing for everyone. And yet, the bourgeoisie, the late Victorian bourgeoisie, had a response to that, and that was to say that if there are poor people eking out an existence, a barely human existence in places like Whitechapel and Spitalfields or Lower East Side of Manhattan, it was because, if they were poor, it was because they themselves were defective. It's because they themselves had lacked discipline, lacked moral character, or in some ways had failed to internalize the rules of normal civilized behavior. Now, fast forward up through the 1980s and 1990s. And what you see in the 1980s and 1990s is a group of right-wing intellectuals who started to popularize the notion of the underclass, the notion that the source of all of the problems in American cities, problem of crime, problem of poverty, the problem that they kept talking about endlessly, namely the problem of what they called out-of-wedlock birth, or the breakdown of the family in the inner city. All of these problems they traced back to the existence of what they called a permanent urban underclass, who were portrayed as pathological. They had pathological behavior. They had a lack of moral values. They were unable to control their behavior. They were almost inherently violent. They were prone to violence. And essentially, they were this image of the underclass was a recycling of the very old late Victorian notion of the pauper. And the proposal that was trotted out by people like Charles Murray and William Bennett and other right-wing intellectuals was that the solution to the problem of the permanent underclass was basically identical to the late Victorian solution to poverty and to the existence of the slums, namely to make welfare as punitive as possible, and instead of trying to meet the deep and pressing social needs of these people and material needs of people who have been, for one reason or another, have ended up at the very bottom of our economic hierarchy. Instead of doing that, the solution that they proposed was to discipline and police them. So you have this, you see this embrace of what I would argue are late Victorian social policies and late Victorian policies of kind of social control over the poor and urban working class. But what made it even more significant and gave it kind of political and cultural resonance is the way that the media embraced the right's discourse about the poor and essentially accepted wholesale the way in which the right and conservatives and people like Charles Murray, William Bennett, Rudolph Giuliani, the way they were talking about the inner city and the urban poor became popularized, thanks in large part to the corporate media. I did a very detailed, in-depth study of television news coverage of urban issues, and especially of the inner city. And I looked at literally hundreds upon hundreds of individual television news stories. And what I found was kind of striking, because I was actually a little bit surprised by some of my findings. One of the things that I found was that, in fact, even though I saw in kind of looking at the general culture and at the intellectual discourse of the 1980s and 90s, this uptick in interest in the city and its problems, nevertheless, there was a remarkable lack of attention in the mainstream news media to realities in the urban core in the 1980s and 90s. And let me just give you an illustration. In one of the years that I looked at, in 1997, I found a handful of stories about urban poverty. Just a handful of stories about urban poverty. One story about unemployment in cities. And this was at a time when unemployment in the urban core was rather high compared to the rest of the country. I found only two stories about racial segregation, even though in 1997, and as is the case today, American cities were as racially segregated as they were at the beginning of the civil rights movement. I found, and the stories that I found about racial segregation, none of them concerned racial segregation in American cities today. Instead, they all concerned segregation in the Jim Crow era South. So what they did was they sort of implied that the problem of racial segregation has sort of disappeared, it was a historical problem and has kind of been taken care of. And there were only eight stories in that entire year carried by any one of the networks about HUD, about how the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which is, as you know, the major federal office that deals with urban policy, housing issues, and so forth. So that was striking, that there were really very few stories about the kinds of topics that I was interested in. In that same year, there were over 60 stories, 60 individual news stories carried about the anti-impotence drug Viagra, which which to me indicates with kind of razor-sharp precision exactly who the network television news executives are speaking to and who they think their audience is. They think their audience is interested in Viagra, but they're not necessarily interested in the problem of urban poverty or homelessness or deindustrialization or racial segregation. So that was the first big finding. But the second finding was something, so that I was a little bit surprised by that, by the relative scarcity of coverage of urban issues in the news media. But my other major finding was something that didn't surprise me at all, and it was that the news media's coverage of urban issues really fit with that pattern that I talked about at the very beginning, the pattern of viewing the inner city really as a fearful, as a terrifying place that was lawless, that was occupied by people who are barbaric or lacking in civilized morality, and that was a recurrent theme. And really, there were only two kinds of stories in the mainstream news media where the inner city figured prominently at all. One was any story having to do with crime or violence. It seemed as if, in looking and analyzing very carefully the news media's coverage of cities, it seemed as if almost every story about cities and about urban areas had some angle that connected it up to violent crime and to bloodshed and mayhem. The vast majority of the stories concerned crime in some way. The same was true in 1998 of all of the network television news coverage of the city of Chicago. Almost all of the stories that were carried about the city of Chicago in that year had to do with crime and criminality. There was a study that was done of television news here in Chicago by a sociologist by the name of Robert Entman, which found that that something like, and I believe I might be wrong like about this, but something like 6 or 7 minutes out of every 14 minutes of every local of the local television newscast that's devoted to actual news, that is, that's not devoted to weather and to sports, that 6 or 7 of the 14 minutes news hole is devoted to violence in some way or another, right? Some sort of violence, either accidents, catastrophes, or crime. And he that was his finding of looking at, you know, looking at local television news. So local television news has been notorious for years for being a blood-drenched and crime-obsessed affair. So what was striking to me is when I was looking at national television news coverage of cities, that you saw the same exact pattern. Now, the other kind of story that that got covered in connection with cities, in national television news coverage of cities, were any stories having to do with the burden that the inner city poor placed on the middle class. And so, for example, in the mid-1990s, welfare and the debate that was taking place in Washington over welfare reform became a huge story and garnered a lot of attention in the national news media, and you saw news crews descending en masse on public housing projects around the country to tape stories about these dependent poor people who were sucking up the American taxpayers' dollars. In the mid-1990s, the typical welfare recipient was not an African-American woman, and she was not living in the inner city, and certainly not in a housing project in the middle of Chicago, not in a place like Cabrini Green. The typical welfare recipient is white and lives in the suburbs. And the reason she was receiving welfare typically was because she had had a change in her marital status, she'd gotten divorced, and her husband wasn't paying child support. That was the absolute, if you look at the statistics, that is the case. And yet in the news media, poverty was consistently, and especially welfare, was consistently racialized to make it seem as if the recipients of welfare, that the people who were receiving money from the state, were predominantly African American and predominantly conform to this stereotypical welfare queen image. Finally, the other big trend that I noticed in, and that I talk about in the book, in media's coverage of urban issues, is the degree to which the media in their news reports showcased the voices of the extreme right. People who were espousing opinions that back in the 1960s or even in the early 1970s would have been considered beyond the pale, would have been considered, you know, extreme right-wing nuts and libertarian crazies, now all of a sudden were showcased as experts whose opinion could be trusted and whose opinion should be valued. And as a case in point, the figure that I like to talk about is Charles Murray. Charles Murray was the author of a book called Losing Ground. And in that book, Charles Murray makes this bizarre argument that social welfare policies designed to eradicate poverty, or at least to ameliorate poverty, are actually responsible for deepening poverty and for thrusting poor women and children in particular deeper and deeper into poverty and making them basically dependent on state assistance. And this argument has no empirical merit whatsoever. Better social scientists than I have demonstrated that a lot of the numbers that Charles Murray used in his book, Losing Ground, were cooked, that he fudges a lot of the figures that he cites, that he wasn't a very good empirical sociologist. But that didn't prevent the book from becoming the banner around which neoconservatives rallied. And all of a sudden, in the 1980s, from the mid-1980s on, he became the most popular and most cited source in the mainstream news media on poverty and on the plight of the inner city. In my reading, oftentimes, people like Charles Murray, or if it wasn't Charles Murray, people like William Bennett, were allowed to speak without being balanced by an equally strident voice from the left. It seems as if, at least according to my argument, the news media embraced their discourse and popularized it and basically just ratified and confirmed everything that Charles Murray and his ilk were saying. But did this have any effect whatsoever? And that's kind of open to debate, but I want to argue that it did have some serious effects, at least on policy and policymakers, because it's during the 1990s, after all, that you have the passage of the Clinton crime bill, right? Which for those of you who aren't familiar with it, basically stiffened penalties for a whole range of different felonies. It created the three strikes and you're out rule, so that if you're guilty of a felony, three times, if you're found guilty of some sort of violent felony, you can be put away for life. It made it possible to prosecute juveniles for a whole new range of offenses as if they were adults. So it criminalized an entire generation of mostly inner city African American and Latino youth. And our prisons are now overflowing with people who have been convicted under provisions of the Clinton crime bill. And the Clinton crime bill would not have been passed, I argue, without the media's relentless drumbeat and demonization of the inner city as this lawless zone of violence, chaos, and bloodshed. Similarly, I would argue that the relentless demonization of the urban poor made the so-called welfare reform of 1996 more palatable to the American people. Because I think that most Americans are sort of decent people. They don't want to see poor women and children living on the streets. They don't want to have to step over the bodies of poor people, right? As they're walking to work or walking to get their Starbucks latte. And yet that's really ultimately what the welfare reform of 1996 made possible, because it put limits to the lifetime assistance that any one person could receive. ultimately don't think that we're going to be able to effectively counteract the right's relentless demonization of the inner city without, first and foremost, without attacking the corporate media and the images that it perpetuates of the city. I mean, I think this has been one of the big problems with the kind of welfare rights organizing that took place, or the organizing against the prison industrial complex that's taken place. I think it's all very good, that the organizing that's gone on, but I think that it often overlooks the power of media to define problems and to define realities in people's minds. And so I would argue that there really is a crying need for people to, first of all, every time you see a kind of demonizing image, the kinds of images that we saw of the residents of Ward 9 in New Orleans in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, every time you see a demonizing image like that, we ought to speak out. I think we need to do a better job of putting pressure on the mainstream media. Every time we see coverage, for example, of the inner city or of urban problems that we disapprove of, we ought to respond, and we ought to respond in a coordinated manner. Secondly, I think that the time is ripe for direct protest. And here I can point to the success of a group out in the Bay Area called the Youth Media Council, who was appalled at the image of the inner city that was being created by, and the kind of the image of the inner city that was being perpetuated by a Clear Channel owned radio station out in the Bay Area. And what they did was they organized demonstrations. They marched down in front of the station and they protested the sort of image that the station was projecting of the African American community as being sort of, you know, promiscuous and lawless and so on, and they protested. And then they went a step further and they filed a petition to deny, with the FCC, a petition to deny the renewal of that station's license to broadcast. Now, I would argue that kind of action where we really confront the broadcasters, the owners of these media, is another thing that needs to be done. And then finally, of course, we're certainly not going to solve the problems of the persistent poverty in inner cities without a movement that addresses the structural problems of our economy. Namely, without a movement that addresses the fact that capitalism needs poverty. And it's interesting, if you look back at the late 19th century and the bourgeois thinkers of the late 19th century, they were very open about this. They believed that people could not be forced to take the kind of low-paying wage slave jobs that they needed them to take in order to keep the capitalist economy running without the constant threat of poverty looming in the background. They knew this. They were open and candid about this. That's why they set up the workhouse system. They wanted to make not going to work for the capitalist as unappealing as humanly possible. Poverty is not an ameliorable side effect of capitalism. It is one of the central effects of capitalism. It is central to the reproduction of capitalism. Capitalism, I would argue, could not exist. Wage labor could not exist without the existence of poverty, mass poverty. And I think we need to be open and honest about that. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't intermediary things that we can do. There certainly could be a more humane capitalism than we have today. But that's not going to ultimately solve the problem. It won't solve the problem for long. And so I think it's important also to draw attention to the fact that capitalism structurally needs poverty in order to exist. And as long as the capitalist system exists, we are going to have cities with neighborhoods that are blighted, where there are masses of unemployed, where there's no options other than the black market economy, be it the drug trade or prostitution or whatever. We are going to have that as long as we have the capitalist system.
And we're now going to expand on just one aspect of that, the war on drugs, We've looked many times at the macro aspects, how factions within the CIA are the major drug importers and exporters, how drugs are kept illegal to maintain their competitive advantage and keep profits up. We've looked at how the war on drugs has been used as a cloak to bring in legislation which would otherwise be unacceptable, like the war on terrorism. Commercially controlled media emphasizes the alien nature of the drug users, presenting them as other, presenting them as dangerous, morally dissolute, alien forces who must be controlled with draconian legislation. I don't think the SWAT teams would have been allowed to have become such a potent force in US policing without the war on drugs, never mind all the legislation about wiretapping and the circumvention of privacy. Our next guest, Dr. Gabor Maté, speaking from decades of personal experience with drug addicts, presents a very different side, emphasizing their humanity, looking at the micro level, why do people become drug addicts, and challenges, in fact, the medical model of addiction, which is very focused on the drugs themselves and ignores the life circumstances of the users, as if anybody's life could be defined not by the thoughts and feelings, but by their external circumstances. Thank you to Mike McCormack for this recent recording. There are many such available from his YouTube channel, which is Talking Stick TV.
We are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Dr. Gabor Maté. Dr. Gabor Maté ran a private family practice in East Vancouver for over 20 years and was also the medical coordinator of the palliative care unit at Vancouver Hospital for 7 years. For over 12 years, he has been the staff physician at the Portland Hotel, a residence and resource center for the people of Vancouver's downtown East Side. Many of his patients suffer from mental illness, drug addiction, hepatitis C, or HIV, or all four. He is the author of 4 books, When the Body Says No, The Cost of Hidden Stress, Scattered Minds, A New Look at the Origins and Healing of Attention Deficit Disorder, Hold On to Your Kids, Why Parents Need to Matter More Than Peers, co-authored with developmental psychologist Gordon Neufeld. And he is here to talk about his latest book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. Let's start out. Tell us, what was the motivation in writing your latest book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts?
As soon as I began to work in Vancouver's downtown East Side, which is notorious as being North America's most concentrated area of drug use, with an estimated 5,000 heavy injection users within a 10-block radius, a 10-block square area. And being a writer, I knew that I had a book on my hands here, just telling the stories of these people and telling about the work down there. What I didn't realize is that there are many aspects to addiction that medical science has discovered, but medical practice is yet to incorporate, and our understanding of addiction is very primitive compared to the knowledge that is actually available to us. So the book became not just the stories and the often very tragic stories of my patients and my work with them, but also an exploration of the addicted brain, how it develops, social attitudes, the word towards addiction, our political and legal medieval responses to addictions, despite the evidence that we now have, and also an exploration of healing and potential pathways for a more sane, rational, compassionate, and scientific approach to the treatment of addiction.
So define addiction for us.
Well, most definitions of addictions include some kind of a substance. Mine doesn't. I define addiction as any behavior that has negative consequences, but is associated with craving and relapse and loss of control over that behavior despite those negative consequences. In other words, I'm saying that addiction is a continuum from the highly respected workaholic at the apex of the social pyramid to the street-haunted drug addict who is suffering with mental illness and is facing social opprobrium at the very base. And so that in our society, there's hardly any buddy who's not to one degree or another affected by addiction, whether we recognize that or not. And in my case, as a workaholic doctor, with all kinds of negative consequences on my personal, spiritual, and family life, and I did that for many years, in my behaviors, I was not all that different from my addicted clients, although, of course, in a different realm and with different consequences.
So what do you see as then the contributing factors towards one becoming addicted?
If you look at, again, the common view of addiction, that it's a matter of a bad choice, a moral lapse, an ethical failure, a stupid decision that some makes. When you actually look at it, you're struck by two things. One is that it's very much a condition of the brain. And you can show on brain scans and other brain studies which circuits are involved, number one. And the more you recognize the brain function and how an automatic it is, the less you think that there's actually much of a choice in the matter. That's the first point. The second point is, if you look at what shapes those brain circuits, it's now known that the human brain develops not according to some random or strictly defined genetic program, but in fact in interaction with the environment. And if you look at the hardcore drug addicts who are at the extreme end of the scale that I work with in the downtown east side, invariably they were severely abused children. The women were all sexually abused, many of the men were, and they all suffered neglect and deprivation in the emotional sense and often in the physical sense as well. Large, significant percentage are First Nations peoples, Aboriginal peoples in Canada, who are really at the bottom of the social pyramid, politically, economically, and socially. And these early experiences actually shape the brain in certain ways that make addiction, if not totally inevitable, highly likely. And the same thing has been shown in large-scale American studies, so that in large population studies they've shown that the most significant influence on injection drug use in adulthood is the depth and duration of adverse experiences in childhood.
So in addition to being raised in an abusive family setting or lack thereof, then what other factors go into that? For instance, is stress a contributor to this?
Stress both early in life, already during pregnancy. If you stress mothers during pregnancy, their kids will be more likely to crave alcohol as adults. This has been shown in animal studies. If you stress mothers during pregnancy, as for example a study showed during 9/11, their children will have abnormal stress hormone levels at 1 year of age. And addiction is very often a question of stress regulation. In other words, people drink or they use drugs or they engage in addictive behaviors like eating or shopping or gambling when they're stressed. So if the early stress regulation parts of the brain don't develop properly because the parents were so stressed, not necessarily abusive, but just highly stressed, that would predispose the child towards addiction later on. And then, of course, the research shows that the biggest driver, the biggest trigger for addictive relapse is stress. So that during an economic crisis like right now, predictably, a lot more people are eating junk food or people are eating more junk food because junk foods release the same chemicals in the brain that the drug addict is after, which is to say the endorphins, which is the brain's natural opiates, and dopamine, which is the brain's natural incentive, motivation, and vitality chemical. These substances are released through addictive behaviors and by the addictive drugs as well. So when people are stressed, they'll do something addictive because at that moment that'll give them some stress relief and some soothing and some of those feel-good chemicals that make them feel more balanced and less troubled momentarily. But of course, with more craving that crops up almost right away. And in some families, postpartum depression on the part of the mother is a predisposition towards problems later on in life. And not because these mothers are bad mothers or abusive mothers or anything but loving mothers, but because when the parents are depressed, they can't have that quality of emotional connection with the child, much as they love the child. They can't be as attuned to the child as they would like to be. And it was here in Seattle at the University of Washington some years ago that an electrical encephalogram study was done of infants at 6 months of age. That's an EEG, which is an electrical readout of the neurological activity of the brain. And they compared the EEGs of six-month-old infants whose mothers were depressed to infants whose mothers were not depressed. And they could tell from the EEG of the child whose mother was depressed and whose wasn't. In other words, the child's brain is programmed by the emotional states and the quality of the emotional interaction with the parent. And this has been shown in all kinds of animal studies and human experience and so on. And so that means that what happens to us early in life is a decisive influence in shaping how we might go later on. It's not the only influence, but it's an important one. It's a crucial one. And so that's another risk factor. And then there's one more factor in our society, which I talk about in our book, Hold On To Your Kids, which is that human beings were never meant to be brought up in nuclear families. We always grew up in clans, tribes, villages, neighborhoods, communities, extended families. As the African saying goes that Hillary Clinton was fond of quoting, it takes a village to raise a child. So in a natural habitat for human beings, children are raised by a whole network of nurturing adults. Now, that's totally broken down in our society. Not only don't we have the clan, tribe, community, village, neighborhood, we don't have the extended family anymore because of economic dislocation and all kinds of stress. And the nuclear family is under such stress that both parents have to work very often to make a living. And so kids will grow up around other kids in daycares, and so that the primary connection for children very often becomes no longer the nurturing adults, but other children. And another factor that really drives addictive behaviors is the peer influence. But the peer influence is not a natural one. It's a completely unnatural consequence of social disintegration. So there are many cultural and social and economic influences that are driving addiction, but they all come down to what environment children grow up in.
But wouldn't peer influence be there in a healthy village?
No, in a healthy village, when you walk down to a village in Africa, if you're an adult, kids you've never seen before in your life will call you uncle or aunt. They relate to you like an adult because that's how they used to relate to nurturing adults. So they're not just looking to other kids for modeling and how to be in values and how to behave. They're looking to adults. And initiation in traditional cultures happens from elders, not from peers. What happens when you get initiation from peers is you get the teenage gangs. When you get initiation from adults, you get introduced into the adult culture. And so that there's tradition and security behind that. Whereas in a gang, you have nothing but insecurity. And so that's another major risk factor in North America. And if you look at the kids who are most at risk, they happen to be the minority kids in the United States whose family life have been totally disrupted by hundreds of years of history. Very often the fathers aren't around, and these kids get into gangs very early. And they're the ones who are in jail because of marijuana and cocaine problems. And so we end up punishing people for the fact that they didn't have the right conditions when their lives began.
Sticking with talking about the influence of mothers when they're carrying the babies, we would often hear things that, for instance, smoking while you're pregnant is bad.
Yeah.
Do you think the bigger contributor there is the tobacco or the situation that is causing stress that turns one towards using the tobacco?
Well, first of all, it's interesting because tobacco, of course, is a stimulant. So tobacco releases nicotine as a stimulant, like caffeine is, like cocaine is, and like crystal meth is. So the tobacco smoker is after the same brain chemical that the cocaine injector is after. And it gives a momentary calm and wakes them up and all that kind of thing. Now, first of all, a significant percentage of smokers have ADHD, because how we treat ADD is with stimulants like Ritalin and Dexedrine, which also release dopamine in the brain. So first of all, a lot of mothers who smoke already have an addicted problem. Number one, if they have an addictive problem, it means that they've had stressed lives. And that means that, and the smoking is one way of soothing stress. So your question is very apt. Is it the effect of the tobacco, or is it the effect of the stress? So the answer is both. You know, smoking will have deleterious effects on the developing system of the child, but so will the stresses that the mother is inadvertently trying to soothe through the cigarette habit. So it's a combination of both. And, you know, a British study showed that women who are abused by their partners, their children will have more likely to have ADHD during pregnancy their children were more likely to have developmental conditions like ADD, for example. And when you look at the placenta at the time of birth, there's higher level of the stress hormone cortisol. Now, that which makes sense, because when people are under stress, they release more cortisol. Now, cortisol has a major effect on brain development and in other ways as well. So that, you know, it all comes together. You can't isolate any single factor. But what you can say is that the more stressed the environment is for a child, the more likelihood addiction will somehow crop up. And that means that in our society, with the breakdown of family and extended family and village and all that, many of us grow up under stressed circumstances to one degree or another. Most stressed are the kids who are actually abused. And they're the ones who end up in the streets with injection drug use problems and intractable ones. But again, it's a continuum.
It would appear that then the most stressed environment that there could be on our planet would be war zones. Do you see high addiction rates in war zones?
Where it's been studied, you certainly show that the kids who grow up under wartime situations have more traits that would predispose them to addiction. I don't know if there's been a direct study linking that kind of situation to addiction per se, but they certainly have been linked to personality traits that are more likely to lead to addiction in themselves. Having said that, a lot of it depends on the quality of the nurturing relationships that surround the child. Because children who might experience stress in the external sense, but who are well ensconced in nurturing relationships, are still better off than kids who live under safer, quote-unquote, circumstances, but who are bereft of those nurturing adult contacts.
What about situations like in your book you write about Vietnam and the veterans there who were under stress?
Well, that's a typical example. Vietnam is a typical example because the study showed that after the war, when the GIs returned, 20% of them were addicted to heroin. 20%. And now there's this general myth that drugs cause addiction. You do a drug, you get addicted, which is, of course, scientific nonsense. And as the Vietnam experience showed, because after a few years, only 5% of those, only 1% of the GIs were addicted. So 95% of these addicts amongst them got over their addiction fairly quickly. Now, if the drugs by themselves could induce the addiction, they all sort of stayed addicts. And if drugs by themselves cause addiction, then you couldn't go to the hospital and get a morphine for pain. But you can give people morphine for pain for a long time if they need it. And once the pain is gone, they quite rapidly get off their morphine so that the drugs themselves don't cause the addiction. It's a susceptibility. Now, when you look at that 1% of the GIs who stayed addicted, they were the ones who came from troubled families. And for the rest, it was the stress of the war. So now, first of all, you have to notice that out of 100 GIs, 80 didn't become addicted at all. 20 did. And for them, and for most of them, it was the specific stress of the war plus a mild susceptibility. But once they got back stateside, with the stress of the war, of a meaningless and very dangerous and cruel war, had been lifted from their shoulders, the addiction burden was also lifted from the shoulders. The small minority that stayed addicted were the ones that were highly predisposed because of what had happened to them early in life.
So do you see in other societies beyond North America, then the addiction rates are noticeably lower?
Well, I mean, a good case example is that of the experience of Aboriginal peoples in North America. Before the coming of what we like to call European civilization, to North America, there were addictive substances here. That is to say, substances that had addictive potential, such as tobacco, such as alcoholic spirits in some areas, and peyote. But there's absolutely no evidence or history of addiction on a mass scale at all, or even close to anything close to it. These substances were used in spiritual ways, in communal ways, under the guidance of elders and shamans. Now, if you look at the addiction rate amongst Aboriginal people in Canada, and I would guess in the United States as well, in our streets in the downtown east side, in our jails in Canada, for sure, you have a tremendous, disproportionately high ratio of Aboriginal people. But what happened to these people? They were dislocated from their homes. Their livelihood was denied to them. They were massacred. In Canada, at least, for generations, they were forced to send their children to these residential schools run by churches of all denominations, where they were sexually and physically and morally abused. And that's that dislocation then, and of course their natural ways of making a living were deprived from them, they're deprived of them because of the land needs and claims of the settler population that displaced them. And they were forced into reservations, and their spiritual ways were invalidated, and now you have a huge addiction problem where in some native areas of Canada and reservations, you have an 80% addiction rate. And it's tragic, and the abuse is passed on from one generation to the next. And if you look at American statistics, the most likely to be sexually violated is a Native American woman, and 80% of the time by non-Native men. In Alaska, at least, that's true. Sarah Palin doesn't talk about that too much, but it happens to be a statistical fact. So then no wonder then that these people then, you know, find addictive substances to soothe their tremendous pain, because if you look at all the addictive substances in one way or another, they're all painkillers. And so the central question in addiction, to my mind, is, and which as I say in my book, is not why the addiction, but why the pain.
That begs the question of then how did you get people to get off their addiction?
Sure.
That would be by stopping the pain, wouldn't it?
That's exactly right. So when you look at the war on drugs, see, if you had a bunch of geniuses huddled in around a situation table in some room, they say to themselves, hey, we know that the scientific evidence is clear that the biggest driver of addictive behaviors is stress. How should we help the drug addicts in our country? Let's make war on them. Let's ostracize them. Let's impoverish them. Let's judge them mercilessly. Let's criminalize them. Let's throw them into jails where there's no help for them whatsoever. Overcrowded jails where they're treated harshly. And after that, let's throw them back onto the streets. That's the way to get rid of their addiction, for sure. I mean, who would come up with such a system? But that's the system we got, for the most part. Now, of course, given that what caused addiction was the lack of nurturing and support in the first place, the solution is to nurture and support people. And so approaches that meet people where they're at, even to the extent of allowing them to use their substances under, you know, nurturing supervision, wherever that's been tried, the results are great. And, you know, in Seattle, there are places where people are, there's a low threshold alcohol. You know, I think the residence is called 1811, and people end up drinking less alcohol that way. And in Vancouver, we have the supervised injection site, where people are allowed to come and bring their substances and inject. We don't give them their substances. I would like to. The studies that where we do that, they have shown nothing but good results. But at least they're being on substances. They inject under supervision. If they overdose, they get help. Lives have been saved. And people get clean needles and a sterile swab, so they're no longer using puddle water in the back alley to inject. But they're getting sterile water to inject with. There's less disease transmission, obviously. Hepatitis C, HIV, all kinds of other infective organisms are not passed on from one person to another. And people have the opportunity to receive some compassionate care, which is their first step towards some kind of rehabilitation. So that the real solution here is not more harsh and more punitive and restrictive measures, but actually embracing the addict at whichever level they happen to be at. Now, for some people, that might mean immediate abstinence. If that's where they're at, that's great. You just simply can't accept or expect that everybody will be at that level, and you have to bring them along stepwise. So there has to be a wide-ranging, stepwise, graded, compassionate, science-based, humane medical and social treatment program, which we could do financially quite nicely if we didn't waste all this money on this retrograde and demonstrably, incontrovertibly worse than useless war on drugs.
Only a few minutes left. How much does our society contribute to addictions from the standpoint of it being a consumer society, that we don't have citizens, we have consumers?
Well, culturally, look at the absurdity. We point our finger at the drug addict and we say, how can you be putting something toxic into yourself that you know is going to destroy you? Let me get into our SUVs and, you know, the kind of industries that we have that are destroying, because of our attachment to short-term pleasure and the consumer culture, we're literally destroying the earth. That's not controversial anymore, except maybe in the former White House and in Canada's current cabinet offices. But other than that, nobody with any credibility argues very much anymore that, you know, global climate change is not a problem for us that we're creating because of our consumerism. In other words, we have lived in an addicted culture. Because my definition of addiction, again, is any behavior with negative consequences that we continue to crave and relapse into despite those negative consequences. What do you call the consumer culture? It's a massively addictive culture. And, of course, advertising exploits people's natural susceptibilities and vulnerabilities. And so basically the advertisement fundamentally says to you, soothe yourself with this particular product. This will make you happy. This will make you feel okay about yourself. Do this, be that, buy this, and you'll be okay for the first time in your life. And furthermore, without these things, you're inadequate. So without attainment, possession, you know. So that although advertisement and the consumer culture can't by itself create addiction simply because of the messages it sends out, it powerfully hooks into people's insecurities and exacerbates them. And of course, creates more social dislocation, which then feeds the addictive drive of large numbers of people. And I do talk about that issue in the book as well, just this particular dynamic of the social encouragement towards addiction.
So what do you recommend to those listening who are battling with their own addictions?
Well, first of all, you have to get it, that what you're doing is addictive. Whether that's work that's keeping you from your family, whether it's you're spending a lot of money that you don't need to on products you don't need, whether it's eating, whatever it is, you have to get that that has an impact on your life. You have to see the impact. Secondly, you need to see, as they say in the 12-step groups, that you have no power over it, that your little ego, your little personality, its stratagems and its ideas are not sufficient to overcome the addictive problem, and that's, I've had to face that in my own life. Thirdly, buy my book, because actually a lot of people have told me that it's really transformed their lives. But the real issue is whether you buy my book or not, seek help. Go to a 12-step group, speak to a counselor. Begin at least by acknowledging the problem. That's the first step. I mean, if you don't acknowledge the problem. But also realize that inside you, there's the part that recognizes the problem is the healthy part of you. In other words, we all have a healthy part of us that can lead us towards a healing path. It doesn't matter how far we think we've gone in any kind of addictive trajectory, there's always healing possible. So you have to keep that possibility in mind and not give up on yourself.
Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We have just been talking with Dr. Gabor Maté, author of the new book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. And in addition to his book, you can also find out more about his work via his website, drgabormaté.com, which is drgabormate.com.